This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay. So good afternoon. My name is Deborah Bierer. I am both a panelist and I'm filling in today as moderator because unfortunately Sherman Cohn is not able to be with us today. So I'm honored to moderate this panel. We're going to be talking about the death penalty and crime and punishment sort of more broadly. So I'll introduce our panelists in just a moment, but just to sort of segue from our most recent panel on debt forgiveness, in many ways, there's an affinity between these two panels because we're talking about contexts in which something has gotten out of balance and we need to restore some kind of social equilibrium. Namely, in the last panel, when an individual falls into some form of significant financial debt, how are the courts involved in rectifying that and addressing that and potentially perpetuating that? And our panel approaches a similar set of questions, but from a different angle. We'll be exploring systems of crime and punishment. And within that conversation, we're going to look at the death penalty as a particular case that highlights some of the central issues and challenges at the heart of the penal system. So as we move through this conversation, we'll explore questions related to the status of the criminal, the goals of criminal punishment, the role of religious conceptions of human dignity, forgiveness, and the afterlife, and the role they might play in judicial and penal systems, specifically within the context of capital punishment. And we're going to structure this more like the last panel, just sort of as a conversation between us, but also to invite all of you to join in that conversation at any point. So I will leave time. We have, I believe, about an hour and 20 minutes. I will leave time at the end for questions. But if during the course of our conversation, you'd like to jump in on a specific point, just sort of signal to me and I will try to bring you into the conversation at that point. So first, let me just introduce our panelists. We have Dr. Stephanie Arell at the end, who works on issues of the criminal justice system, trauma, and has a book. She's the author of Affect Theory, Shame, and Christian Formation. She works both on sort of the secular legal system and justice in the U.S., but also brings a perspective from philosophy, psychoanalytical theory, and the Catholic tradition to our conversation. And then we also have Dr. Jenny Lebenz, who works in rabbinic literature and specifically in the Talmud, also on issues pertaining to capital punishment. And she has written a book called Socratic Torah, Non-Jews in Rabbinic Intellectual Culture. You can see more about these wonderful panelists and all of their fabulous accomplishments in the pamphlet that you already have. But we'll hear more about the different lenses they're going to bring to the conversation. As I said, I'm Deborah Bierer. My research is also somewhat like Dr. Lebenz is on rabbinic literature and thought and rabbinic decision-making, law, and ethics in rabbinic narratives. So those are sort of the lenses of where we're coming from. So let's move into our conversation. Okay. I'd like to begin the conversation by focusing on the question of capital punishment or the death penalty in particular, and then we're going to broaden out to talk about various aspects of criminal punishment. So many of you may be familiar with Raymond Carver's series of short stories, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. And his evocative title has inspired many others, including Nathan Englander's more recent collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. And I'd like to draw on that formulation and begin our panel by asking, what do we talk about when we talk about the death penalty? And before I ask our panelists to respond, maybe I'll frame this question a little bit more pointedly. So Jenny, you work on rabbinic literature. While there are whole chapters of the Mishnah and Gemara focused on capital punishment, many scholars have questioned whether or not the rabbis ever actually carried out a criminal execution. If rabbis are not concerned primarily with the practical questions surrounding execution, and if in fact they never carried out an execution, what do you think rabbinic death penalty discourse is trying to address? What other questions or concerns do the rabbis raise in the course of these conversations? Or as Beth Berkowitz framed the question in her own study of the rabbinic death penalty, what work does the ritual of execution do for the rabbis? Stephanie, you work on criminal punishment, including the death penalty, in the context of the U.S. prison system, a context in which capital punishment has definitively been carried out and is still a legal reality in some states. And yet, as we've seen in the broader public discourse time and again, the death penalty conversation in the U.S. also raises a host of other concerns and considerations. For example, in our current moment, Arkansas is slated to execute 8 men on death row in the span of roughly 10 days because the drug used for the executions is about to expire and there are questions about whether or not we'll be able to get another supply of that drug. And so here we can see economic, moral, and judicial questions all intersecting around the case of executing these specific convicts and overlapping in the broader discourse around the death penalty. So I'm curious to hear, Stephanie, what you view as the primary concerns raised by conversations about capital punishment in the contemporary U.S. discourse, and to explore whether those concerns overlap, the degree to which they overlap with the concerns raised in rabbinic discourse. So maybe we can start there. And Jenny, perhaps we can start with you with the ancient context, then we'll move forward to the modern context.
Sure. So first of all, to set the stage regarding Talmudic rabbinic discussions of capital punishment. First of all, we're going to use the terms rabbinic literature and Talmudic literature. And to, I guess, state for the first time or restate from before. So this is a set of really anthological Jewish literature from the first, from the first 5 centuries of the Common Era, dealing with not just practical legal questions, but sort of everything under the sun. So when it comes to Talmudic discussions of capital punishment, the rabbis who wrote this literature are living under the secular authorities of the Roman and either if they're in one area of the world, the Roman government or under the Persian government. So it's not actually, these aren't actually practical discussions that they're having about capital punishment, although you would think so from reading it. It's written as though these are sort of instructions for how to carry out a practical system, but we can be fairly certain, and there's no way to know for sure, and there's some debate, but we can be fairly certain that they didn't actually execute anyone, both from a historical perspective, because it's highly unlikely that the Jews in the Roman Empire or the Persian Empire ever had the opportunity to execute a criminal, or for that matter, that they dealt with anything other than civil and religious law, and criminal law was something they talked about and were interested in but didn't have any authority over. And also from the internal evidence of the Talmud, it seems very unlikely that a lot of the things that they were talking about were ever carried out, either because they are sometimes just sort of bizarre or really impractical, and they don't seem to be instructions that were followed. So on the other hand, it seems very clear that the rabbis of the Talmud thought it was extremely worthwhile to think through, down to the nitty-gritty detail, all the issues you can think of regarding capital punishment. And I think that has to do with the fact that they are religious people concerned to delineate their communal identity and their values. And the main reason that capital punishment is a valuable topic through the lens of which to do that is that it tests the limits of their values, right? How we treat a person who has committed what the Bible or the rabbis consider to be a capital offense tests what we are willing to do as a society and as individuals to another human being. I mean, it tests the limits of our inclusivity when it comes to human dignity, and it tests the limits of the boundaries of our communities. Furthermore, capital punishment brings up these questions about what a society's responsibilities are to someone who's been convicted of the most extreme crimes, however the society defines what those should be. What are our economic responsibilities to such a person, our physical responsibilities and communal responsibilities to such a person? Another way in which I think it, for the rabbis, articulating the answers to these questions in the context of a criminal is important is if we shift our perspective, and we'll come back and talk more about this in a little while, about what is a criminal. So we're accustomed, I don't know if we in this room, but society in general is accustomed to think about criminals as sort of the lowest part of society. And on the other hand, it's also possible, and I think the rabbis do, view people who've been convicted of capital offenses as the most vulnerable members of society. They are controlled completely by the authorities. They can't escape. Their very life is about to be taken from them. And they are, in fact, in the theological system of the rabbis, about to face their maker and be held to account for what they've done in their life. And so how they are treated reflects on, you know, how we take care of the vulnerable, whether or not they deserve to be in that vulnerable position or they did nothing to deserve to be in that vulnerable position. This I always wonder whether this should be stated outright or whether it's obvious, but this takes us to the all-important kal vachomer argument, the how much the more so. If this is how much, if we afford dignity to the convicted criminal, how much the more so should we do those same things to other people? This is that question of limits. You test the most extreme cases and then work backwards from there. And the last thing I want to say is that so a context like this is, I think, exactly the most significant way in which we can engage in Talmudic literature on this topic. Because it's not that this is a part of the religious tradition that anyone, the most, you know, religiously inclined or halachically inclined, that it's not a part of the religious tradition that any of us is looking to adopt capital punishment that we would be involved in some way, or impose on our legal system in any way. But what we can do with these Talmudic discussions is to use the practical details and that they put out there, not as practical guides or models, but as a way to find moments of wisdom and springboards for inspiration to point us in more moral and social and psychologically thoughtful directions when we're considering the topic of criminal punishment as a whole. So I'll leave it at that for now. And Joanna.
Why don't you speak to the modern
context? I'm going to shift a little bit to the sort of genealogy of the prison system and then highlight where that leaves us today with this case in Arkansas. So Jenny talked a little bit about the ancient originations of prisons and the concept of the Roman prisons, which were really considered initially to be a sort of containing place before punishment was enacted. So the punishment came later. The prisons were just holding cells. It wasn't until with the 17th and 18th century that we start to see a difference in the consideration of what the prison as a container is interpreted as. So, and this mostly comes from Michel Foucault, who talks about this idea of discipline and the prison systems being a place where we're now disciplining people separate from the public spectacle that we could call the death penalty with the guillotine and such, other punishments as well, but especially highlighting the guillotine. So when we start to distinguish this a system of discipline from a system of punishment, we start to get these sort of like two thoroughfares where we've got prison and the death penalty. And I want to shift just a little bit to how we then interpret the prison. So, and I want to also say that this system of discipline did not just apply to the conceptualization of the prison. It extends to the mental health institution, to educational organizations, etc. So it's a whole mentality about how we're training people to be some such. In the Enlightenment, there was this response secularly to the idea of public spectacle and punishments. And in order to pull away from that, the prison system became a softening and a place we could kind of hide where these type of punishments were taking place. Simultaneously, there's a Christian movement to start to interpret the imprisonment as a response to sin. So again, I'm going to be operating solely within a Christian framework. And I'll get to a little bit of the Catholic social ethics response to that later, not quite now. So there we've got the division, and then we've got one division in between punishment and discipline that start to collide, but then also a secular response and a Christian response. The image that I would like to give to you in terms of how this is transforming is the image of the Panopticon. I don't know if any of you have been to Boston, but there's the Liberty Hotel is actually a panopticon. If you stand in the middle of the hotel lobby and you look up, the building is a circle. And theoretically, in terms of a prison, you should be able to see what's going on everywhere within the prison. So that's a mental health model as well that is actually, I think, only in my experience. I worked in a mental health institution, and it was about in the those institutions sprung up, I would say, in the 80s, and I think have started to dissolve in their the more moderate versions have started to dissolve. I think the extreme versions still exist, where we've got this idea of the eye. In the place where I worked, there were a series of mirrors set up so that if you were standing anywhere in a place where the patient was not allowed to be, you could actually see everywhere based on reflections of the mirrors. So it's that same kind of concept. In the 1950s, the envisionment of prisons as a response to the Holocaust began to be altered. And I would say by the 70s, that became concretized in terms of thinking about prisons as much, much more than a holding cell and as a response to social problems. But in a very ironic twist of events, the Holocaust provided the models with how to do that. So, the history, I would say, is loaded with ethical issues from a Christian perspective, and one that I'd like to highlight, where often I'm not a lawyer, but I think a lot of the times how law responds to this is to or the critique is that the prison system is actually built on a guilt ethics, where you've done something wrong. You're going to pay for that wrong, whether you pay through fines or punishment, whether you go to prison or whether you receive some sort of debt. It's presumed to be based on this guilt ethic. However, the current arguments, and I think an argument we could probably all make, has to do with the fact that the prison system is more regulated on a shame ethics, which has to do with this dehumanization of the criminal as a human entity to something that's subhuman, which Jenny alluded to. So that ethic is one problem in this discourse of what we call discipline and punish. Another problem, which was alluded to in the last panel, which I'm sure we could talk about, has to do with mass incarceration, perpetuation of economic issues, and the poor within the prison system. And then I would say I want to return to the Arkansas case just to tell you what's at stake before we move on with this issue of the punishment and the way that they're going to use the drugs. And we'll get to this explicitly. I want to articulate it now because I'll respond to it later from a Catholic social ethics perspective. And that is the drug that they want to use is the one that debilitates consciousness, which should be injected first. Then there's a second drug that's injected that paralyzes the person who's going to be killed. The third drug stops the heart. And so what they're worried about right now, well, those that are concerned, is that they're going? The drug midazolam has failed multiple times in arresting consciousness, so they're going to quickly try to kill two people a day. I think for 8 to 10 people, so it's 2 people a day for this period in Arkansas. Yes, Arkansas. I keep messing the state up. So they risk the person having a loss of consciousness. They've already spent $85,000 training the people in the prisons to be able to deal with this in the case that that drug fails. So the prisoner will still die. It's just that they'll know it's happening while it's happening. So the psychological toll, what's at stake, is not only the prisoner, but the psychological toll it takes on the people exacting the deaths. So the case where this failed was in Oklahoma in 2014. It happened twice, once in Arizona and once in Oklahoma. And the reports from the people that enacted the death are horrific because of what they went through. And then they stopped the witnesses from being able to see the event. And so it's a very... In terms of human rights and human dignity, I think it's a huge violation.
Excellent. Well, do you want
to,
yeah.
I just wanted to jump in with one point that a parallel in Talmudic literature to the arresting consciousness, although it's not as sort of fully thought out, but not to worry, it never was used, is that the convict before they're executed is to be given like a liquor of some sort that's intended to... essentially get them drunk so they won't experience, they won't really understand what's going on. So in a sort of very basic form, what that drug is trying to do. And the language in the Bible that's based on, so the rabbis are looking to the Bible for sort of an inspiring quotes to undergird what they do, is a verse from Proverbs that says, give wine to one who is lost and liquor to one who is of bitter soul, which in the context of Proverbs is terrible advice. You know, just drown your sorrows in alcohol. But the rabbis take that to mean, who's that person who is lost and who is of bitter soul and who needs compassion, who it's the community's responsibility to provide sort of anesthetic to in that form. And that's a person, a convicted criminal who's about to be put to death. So it dovetails with the theme of the convict being of the most vulnerable in society.
So I just want to pick up on a theme that I think sort of came up in both the rabbinic literature and these contemporary cases, that the death penalty raises, especially the sort of horrific cases of executions gone awry in some sense, is this anxiety because of the extremeness of death, in contrast to a limited prison term, at least, where in theory, if the judgment were wrong, it could be overruled, the person could be set free, and we've seen there's all kinds of issues surrounding that as well, wrongful conviction. But the extremity of death, once somebody is executed, not only in the burden that places on the executioners, but also that can never be undone. And so there's an interesting passage in the Tosefta in Sanhedrin 9:5 that I just want to share this sort of as a way of transitioning to thinking about how do we get to the point of execution, and how do we try to secure in the minds of the community, in the minds of the judge, maybe in the minds of the executed, that the judgment is correct? What do we do if there's concerns that it's incorrect? So I'm just quoting here. This is a translation. Chaya Halberstam talks about this anxiety a lot in an excellent book she has on law and truth in biblical and rabbinic literature. So I'm quoting from her translation. It happened once that there was a person who was led out to be stoned. And again, this is a context, as Jenny was saying, that may never have actually occurred, but we have the story as if it's occurring. They said to him, confess. He said, let my death be an atonement for all of my sins, but if I did this thing, let God not forgive me and let the Israelite court be innocent, which is a way of saying, I didn't do this, right? Because if you did it, you want God to forgive you. So you're not going to say, don't forgive me. Now, when this report came to the sages, their eyes flowed with tears. They said, to reverse this is impossible, for there will be no end to the matter. But lo, his blood is on the hands of the witnesses. So we see this sort of dramatic scene of anxiety about the possibility of wrongful execution, a miscarriage of justice. Also anxiety about the need to have a system of punishment, and to be able to rely on these judicial processes. And this interesting move, relocating responsibility for that from the judge to the witnesses, the people who testified to the person having committed this crime. So I want to sort of delve into these anxieties a little bit before we actually get to the moment of execution, then we'll get there as well, and think about the judicial processes that lead up to execution, how you both see, either in rabbinic discourses or contemporary legal discourses, people trying to handle these sort of concerns about the potential miscarriage of justice, whether we can ensure, you know, we can never know 100% whether somebody has done something unless, I guess, potentially if they confess to it, but even then there's questions. So how do you see people negotiating this sort of in the lead up to the actual execution?
So I'll say about witnesses, the Bible and the, did you want to jump in? The Bible and the Talmud, both treat the witnesses as the linchpin of the whole judicial system. The judges make the decisions, but it's the witnesses that everything is riding on. And there's no case without witnesses, without direct witnesses. And in both the Bible and then following through in the Talmud's conception, there's like 500 years or 1,000 years between them, let's say, the Bible and the Talmud, just to give some bigger picture. So in both the Bible and the Talmud, there's four methods of execution that the rabbis talk about, and the one that they spend the most time on, sort of the paradigmatic form of execution, is, as Deborah mentioned, stoning. So the witnesses are to throw the first stones. And there's no the whole community is then to join in afterwards. There's no explicit explanation for that, but it seems very much that The idea is that if you're going to do this, you, the witnesses, then you had better be ready to take full responsibility for it, to the point that you will do the execution yourself, you, the witnesses. And then again, though, it's not just the witnesses. The whole community is instructed to participate in this process. Again, the idea is that if we have to confront this process, society as a whole has to confront how it punishes its criminals, and whether it's specifically execution or that's just sort of a metaphor for any sort of punishment, that everyone is involved. I think that's quite different from how Americans tend to think about our penal system and the distance that we put between us and criminal punishment, both physically and sort of socially and psychologically. I should note that it seems, at least in the Bible, that they're perfectly comfortable with this. It's not meant as a deterrence in any way. It seems very much like the biblical authors, even further back in the Talmud, were very happy to execute people or talk about executing people in this way. When it comes to the time of the rabbis, I'm more open to the historical reality that they may actually have thought, this might not be a moral thing to do, and so let's preserve this system of, if you're going to do it, you have to be this sure, this willing, and include the whole society and own that system. One thing to just add to that is that the Talmud also stipulates that after the person is stoned, then the body, this is in some sense based on the Bible, but then the body is hung up, literally. Hanging is not one of the forms of rabbinic execution, but it's used as a way of, again, making this sort of public and part of the society that, you know, we have to own this, we have to face what this means. And it seems in the Talmud, it's not clear what all the texts mean, but it seems, or maybe I would just like it to be, that there is anxiety about what it says about us and our society and the whole process that got us to where we are, that there is this person who's just been killed and we have to face why that happened.
So in terms of thinking about the witness, I'm thinking first where we get a shift in Catholic thought and Jewish thought, and I refer back to this idea of Jesus and the separation of law. And this shift from the concept of eye for an eye versus turn the other cheek and the Beatitudes and Jesus on the Mount. So there's a shift there, I think, in Christian theology that wants to move away from adjudicating any kind of law. The other thing I want to press is this sort a different side of witness, or witness taken from a different angle. And this is what the Catholic social ethic position is. One of the major critiques of the death penalty has to do with the ability to witness it. Because in Catholic social ethics, the community and the church should witness whatever we're doing as a society to anyone. And so if we remove that witness, as we do when we hide the death penalty, is when we put it behind closed doors, then we actually completely subvert Catholic social ethic teachings. We're not doing it. And so if many of you probably know Dead Man Walking, Sister Prejean. So Sister Prejean, who we hosted at Boston University, actually, when she came, this was one of her most emphatic points, was that the point of her writing this book, which she had never written anything and didn't really know what she was doing, as she says, was telling this story to force people to pay attention to and to witness what was happening in the United States to people on death row. So, and she says, as sisters to sisters, brothers to brothers, that if we're going to do this, we have to be able to say that we're doing it. It has to be a part of communal consciousness. And so I counter that with this sort of asking the person on death row to subject themselves to consciousness when we won't be conscious of the same thing. And so the thing I'd like to bring up in the United States context, which I don't know if many of you know who Judge Alex Kaczynski is. His opinion is such, I'm going to read this quote. So one of his critiques of the system of execution is that we hide it behind closed doors. Okay, he's coming from a totally different legal and political position, but his point. But executions are, in fact, nothing serene and peaceful. They are brutal, savage events, and nothing the state tries to do can mask that reality. Nor should it. If we're a society, if we as a society want to carry out executions, we should be willing to face the fact that the state is committing a horrendous brutality on our behalf. So he says, bring back the guillotine and make it in the public square. Because if we, okay, so this is an extreme position, but it does force us to think about as a society what we're advocating in terms of punishment.
I think it's really interesting just hearing you both talk about witnessing in very different contexts, very different types of witnessing. And going back to what you were talking about earlier, Stephanie, with the Arkansas case and this idea that we've seen botched executions where people are still conscious for the execution process and the trauma for the people actually doing the execution, that in an interesting way, I'm just curious if either of you want to reflect on that shift from the people who were witnesses to the crime being the actual executioners in some sense, and then the sense that we've relocated the responsibility of execution to a different set of people, but now maybe there's this new burden of witnessing that relocation. I'm not sure exactly how to phrase that, but I don't know if either of you, it just sort of jumped out to me from the juxtaposition of these two types of witnessing.
What comes to mind when you mention that is the concept of restorative justice. If we leave aside the goals and just think about the method of restorative justice, the point is that the person who's the victim of the crime, and they don't even like to use that language, but and the witnesses all come together with whomever's committed the crime to discuss that particular crime, to dissociate it from the human. So that would be a guilt ethic. Something was committed or done wrong, and then an apology is not only expected, but all parties are expected to engage in the negotiation of the crime, talking about what it meant, who were the witnesses, what did they see, what can we validate in these terms, to come to, I think, a real perspective of viewing the person as a person. So witnessing that person with that person's particular history, which actually, in most cases, tends to be traumatic.
So I think that shift towards restorative justice is a great segue for us to think about sort of more broadly, what are the goals of our systems of punishment, and specifically in the context of this panel of capital punishment. You've talked about restorative justice. We sometimes as a society talk about punishment as a form of rehabilitation. We've talked about punishment as sort of form of retribution. The criminal should pay for what they've done. I want us to sort of think together about what interests capital punishment serves. Is there any way that I think often the inclination is to say it must be punitive. They did something bad. We have to kill them. But is there a way to think about capital punishment as rehabilitative in any sense? Does it accomplish something for the accused, for the victim, for their families, for society at large, that restores some type of equilibrium that's been lost, that affirms some kind of norm that's been broken? Is there sort of any positive consequence? And I guess I'll say I'm asking this question in part because I, since I'm sort of also on this panel, was somewhat invested in this by looking at rabbinic literature on the burial of criminals, and particularly this practice, which has since was active in the early rabbinic period, but not a lot of people know about, of secondary burial. So in this period in time, in antiquity, the body would be buried when they died, and then roughly a year later, when the body was believed to have decomposed, the body would be exhumed, and the bones would be reburied, sometimes in the same site or often relocated. So people would have ancestral tombs, and if there wasn't space to bury every individual initially in the ancestral tomb, you'd bury them somewhere else, and then when the body had decomposed, you'd relocate their bones to rest with their ancestors in this ancestral tomb. And one of the fascinating things that happens in the Mishnah, and then also in Talmudic discussions of criminal burial, is this designation that the criminal has to be buried at a separate court-appointed site. They cannot be buried initially for their initial burial in the ancestral tomb if they're executed by the court. But then there's sort of a debate among different parts of the literature about whether after this one-year period, the body can be reburied the body is, it goes through the secondary burial. It's called ossilegium is the technical term, but there seems to be a debate in the sources about whether that secondary burial occurs in that court-appointed site or whether after that year, the body can be reburied with their family in the ancestral tomb, which would at least potentially symbolize a reintegration of that person into the community after this 1 year period, which corresponds, that 1 year period also corresponds in rabbinic literature to a 1 year period potentially of judgment, an idea. There's a teaching in the Tosefta that the sinners descend to Gehenna for a period of 12 months and then they're released after that period. And there's, we'll talk more about the afterlife sort of at the end. So we'll touch back on this, but there is some sense that potentially there's some period of atonement, or other worldly punishment that the person undergoes in that 1 year period that is enables them to eventually be reintegrated. And some rabbinic passages suggest actually that, the death itself is a form of atonement. So there's a passage in the Talmud in Sanhedrin 47b that says, both for the criminal, both death and shameful burial are necessary for forgiveness. And there seems to be this idea that actually these mechanisms of execution and this initial shameful burial eventually enable the reintegration of the criminal in some sense into society. Admittedly, they are no longer living, but there is some type of reconciliation potentially. And after that secondary burial, the Mishnah records in Sanhedrin 6:6, then there's this ritual where the relatives then come and greet the judges and witnesses as if to say, we have no ill feelings against you in our hearts, for you rendered a true judgment. So for the living who remain, there's also this sort of reintegration that happens after this 1 year period. So this suggested to me, maybe just me, that there may be some type of rehabilitative element to criminal execution, even for the executed, and definitely potentially for society. So I'm curious to see if you see that reflected in either, also if you agree with that assessment of rabbinic literature, but in the contemporary system as well, if there's any sense in which execution can be a rehabilitative practice.
So I want to say I think your reading is excellent. I agree 100%. There seems, through both the language and the sort of meta-analysis that you just summarized, that there is a conviction among the rabbis and in the Bible that there is a cleansing function, that death and post-death spiritual things happening are supposed to have on the convict. And well, similarly, the social function of killing someone in the Bible, the language is that you should kill this person, they deserve to die, and then you will remove the evil from your midst. And I think those are both good impulses, that it'd be nice to remove evil from our midst and just have no more evil. And it's a good idea to think about how to cleanse this person from this crime that is a stain on who they are. But I think it's important to acknowledge that the rabbis, and I imagine you would agree, that the rabbis have a very particular theological set of convictions that I certainly don't share in this realm at all. And where I think this speaks to what I said about why and how I think we should use Talmudic materials on this topic is to say, well, what are the instincts, and are there instincts that are the things that we could emulate or that could point us in good directions for what are the goals of punishment, actual directions that Stephanie can describe where they will take us in real life, like places like restorative justice and true rehabilitation, cleansing the person, removing evil. But as we heard from the in details about on the last panel, and as you know, anyone who knows about our criminal justice system, just punishing someone in the way that we do in America doesn't actually get rid of the evil. It usually perpetuates it and builds on it and creates these sort of never-ending cycles. And the person can only be conceived of as cleansed of their sin through death if you share very specific theological convictions with the rabbi. So it's a good starting point and jumping off point, but not necessarily anything I think we should think about drawing direct parallels with, except in with clear openness and clarity about what are the theological convictions and the anthropological convictions that are driving that understanding of what it would mean to cleanse a human being of sin or of crime.
My first thought, I'm going to jump around just a little bit, and I think we'll get back to restorative justice in a little bit, but my first response to this removing evil from the society and how that would manifest in a contemporary system is to say that that's often the exception, not the rule. And the case that always comes up for me that problematizes my own position on the death penalty relates to Ted Bundy and the fact that he was responsible for 30 known, possibly 100 homicides and other atrocious activities. And so I remember I was living in Florida at the time when he was killed, and I was very little, and I remember this sort of sense of personal relief. And so I always go back to that as the thing that problematizes for me the presence of the death penalty within our legal system. But I think he's an exception. I don't think that that's the way that it generally plays out. And I think that the prison system as it's conceptualized right now is not a place where we see rehabilitation. It's a place where we see debilitation. And I think that with the what we are considering now with the Trump administration and the fact that the Corps of Corrections of America is coming back into power where we saw that receding with the Obama administration, is implicating the for-profit prisons, which will, I don't know how this will play out in the long term, but at the moment, it's highlighting what's going to happen to immigrants, because they're not going to be going into they're not going to be going through the legal procedures that we, as civilians, have a right to, and so those for-profit prisons have a lot to gain in terms of the detention of immigrants. So that's just one way to highlight what we're even considering the prisons for, and it kind of comes back to this idea of a containing cell. But with much more nuance and stigmatization. I think that the mental health system is also guilty of this debilitation, and we bring this back to the idea of the economy, because the insurance companies are primarily the legal the economic sources for mental health care. And so one of the things that I've seen happen more often than not is kids that come in for normal issues whose parent can't contain them, or that have a lot of money or really good insurance, they'll stick the kid in a 6-month hospital, and if the insurance will pay for it, they will send the child to long-term care, so that it gets rid of the burden of parenting. They're not going to jail. They don't have a record, but they're still contained. And so these systems interlace. So we also have a couple of things about statistics. 17,000 murders per year, death sentences in the United States. The murder rate in the states that do not have the death penalty is less than half the national average. So the punishment by death equates to no results in terms of murder. Also, in prisons that, in just the general prison system, the recidivism rate is 67%. That rate drops exponentially when restorative justice is employed. Any kind of practice. And I want to say there's been two, I think there's only two prisons in the country that do this, and I forgive me because I cannot remember which. One is in Massachusetts, and I can't remember the location of the second, but a friend of mine actually just made a documentary on this, which is hospice has been brought into two prisons in the United States. And so what, by asking the prisoners, they train the prisoners to do all the hospice tasks for the other prisoners. So it's nothing external. And the results they're getting from this in terms of recidivism are great. So that is, and to me, the question is, what is that about? And that's about restoring human dignity.
Okay, great. Yeah. That's so. I think on the note of human dignity, this might be a good place to transition to thinking about how we conceptualize the criminal in general and in the context of these cases. You've talked about models of sort of ways we might treat people who we've labeled as criminals that enable reintegration, that restore into society, that restore visions of human dignity. And I think it's an important question for any type of punitive system, including a system that involves execution, to think about how are we envisioning the relationship of the person being punished, whatever that looks like, to the broader society. So how do you see in these different discourses, and maybe I might ask you, Stephanie, to draw in the Catholic tradition here as well, if you're able to, is the criminal conceived as wholly other from the community? Is part of the goals of punishment to separate the criminal from the rest of society? Is part of the goal of punishment to separate the criminal from their crime so that they can be reintegrated into society? And where might execution fit into that conversation? And did I see a question? I thought I saw a hand. Yeah? Go, yeah, I'm happy to integrate them in. I thought I saw someone.
I just wanted to ask, Stephanie, you mentioned human dignity, and I know you've done some work on human dignity. I was wondering whether it's a large part of the discourse here in America. Some countries, human dignity is enshrined in law. I mentioned earlier Germany. It's also in Israel, human dignity is very central. Is it central here in America?
I mean, I can't speak from a legal standpoint on that matter, and I wish I could. I wish I had more knowledge of that. I don't see it emerging in things that I read unless it's from people that are against the death penalty. Frank Thompson was a former executioner, and he's instilling and responding to constitutional language about cruel and unusual punishment, for instance, in terms of qualifying the death penalty as such. So I think that people that are pushing up against it are arguing on the basis of human dignity. But I, as far as I know, and again, I'm not an attorney, but I don't think that it's embedded in our legal language. I do think it's embedded in Catholic social thought. Catholic social thought, because the Imago Dei is such a great part of how we build the teachings. And so if one is created in the image of God, if everyone is created in the image of God, then the prisoner must also be treated as if he or she is created in the image of God. I think the problem that we get within the prison system has to do with the little twist and Christian foundation of American secular society that creates the authority as God. And so there's two different sets of politics there, where the image of God is this authority figure, and one is paying debt, confessing sin to, receiving punishment from, etc., from this God-like secular figure who could be conceived of in many different notions and ways. And I think where that rhetoric plays out is actually within the death penalty, has to do with the rationalization that there's resurrection and there's time for atonement after the death. And so therefore, we're saving this person. So that's where that rhetoric gets played out. And then what happens to human dignity within it?
Is revenge a legitimate feeling on the part of the victim's family? And the concept of Christian forgiveness, as I understand it, that doesn't mean that the person shouldn't suffer, that the perpetrator shouldn't suffer a consequence. And also on a local level, we had a rabbi who engaged in acts of voyeurism that was only discovered afterwards and affected the people emotionally, the women emotionally, and yet there was a very strong feeling in terms of how long you should stay in prison for these acts, which were perpetrated and had a mental impact on the affected women, but didn't have a physical impact on them because they didn't know they were being photographed. I wonder, revenge, Christian forgiveness, and retribution, you could address one or any of those.
You're asking it to me. I think we could all probably weigh in on that. I think at least within so the retributive frame and this idea of revenge, I think doesn't play out well in Christian rhetoric the way that I would conceive it. So that would always have the frame of the Catholic social thought. The concept of forgiveness, though, that's a really interesting one. That's very problematic on one side because of what it asks of the person that should be doing the forgiving. And so I have a problem with the construct within Christian thought myself. So I'm just thinking a lot of what I've been thinking about forgiveness. But I will say that within a restorative frame, which, as it's been conceptualized in the U.S., is based off of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Africa. But really, I would say there were problems in terms of forgiveness within that frame because it was almost projected upon or insisted upon by the victim to forgive. Because if this person who's perpetrated this crime comes forward, then it's your Christian duty to forgive. And so,
more about the Dylann Roof situation, where the parishioners of the church, the survivors, forgave Dylann Roof, but I don't know if that, I think maybe one or two folks said they're not asking for the death penalty, but he is given the death penalty now. Rabbi Talishkin once said, citing the Holocaust, the only person who can give forgiveness is the person who's dead, not the family of the person. But I know it's a very important concept.
I think it's important Christian thinking as well. I think it has problems, and where it has problems and what you're sort of pointing to is this idea of forgiveness and then salvification. Because that going from I'm going to forgive you, so therefore you're saved from this, really does a disservice to the person who's still holding. And so within my point where I was going was within restorative justice, and the way that we're trying to rework it, or the way that many people are trying to rework it, has to do with saying precisely what you just said. So differently, of course, because we're not dealing with people that aren't alive. But it's the idea that the forgiveness can only come from that one individual. And that's a purely very subjective and psychologically nuanced position. And so I'm not convinced by a group of people that forgive some religious figure for doing something wrong. I think there's too much possibility for persuasiveness in whatever direction to enact forgiveness. And so I find it to be something we could actually spend hours talking about, what it means for the individual and then what it means for a community.
If I could actually respond to something you said earlier, Stephanie, in response to the question before about the conception of the criminal and Imago Dei. So there are two, to me, the most powerful aspects of Talmudic criminal justice that I think we can, I hope that in real life are able to be drawn from. There are two particular positions, and it's a parallel, but sort of, I don't know whether to call it on a social level or I don't know how to describe it, but I'll just tell you what it is. You can characterize it as you wish. So the rabbinic discussion that most parallels the Eighth Amendment's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment, the concerns for avoiding excessive pain in the process of the execution, cites a biblical source. Like I said, they like to draw on quotes for inspiration. But the biblical quote that inspires the need to not cause excessive pain is "love your neighbor as yourself" from Leviticus. And in fact, it turns out that that's almost the only context in which that rule is applied specifically. I mean, it's talked about generally, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, but to a specific neighbor, more properly, that's a sort of famous translation, more properly translated probably as friend or peer. Who is the friend who we need to specifically be reminded is someone that you should be, have the kindness that is to think, love this person as yourself, and that is the person who is a convicted, a convict who is about to be executed. That's the first principle. The second famous principle in the Talmud is that even though a person has sinned, that person is still a Jew, which is to say that there's nothing that can take a person out of the exalted category, in this case Jew, but easily extended to human being, member of society, citizen, if that's your inclination, the category into which that they were born. So in contrast, you know, the 13th Amendment outlaws slavery except as punishment for a crime. So the institution from which all Americans are protected is acceptable for convicts. We don't We don't say that this person still has all the rights of a citizen, and that's just one way in which they don't have all the rights of other citizens. And I certainly don't think that in our society we tend to think of a person convicted of a crime as just like us, but convicted of a crime. This category of criminal, just the word, that there is a person who's a different sort of person and they're labeled criminal, is different from at least these two rabbinic principles. And it seems to me that the Talmudic criminal justice system is much more humane in its consideration of the convict, not specifically as a different sort of person, but as someone who's made a mistake or a bad decision. But their human and social status, their sort of category status, is not actually affected.
So I think one of the things that's emerging for me that's really interesting is I've been thinking about these overlapping categories, and now the ways in which they're different are becoming maybe clearer to me in this moment. So on the one hand, I think I've been thinking about rehabilitation and restorative justice as paired in some ways, and also forgiveness and atonement as paired in some ways. But they're actually, I think, emerging as quite different, because in my mind, rehabilitation really focuses on the criminal. And their status, their state, where they're at as an individual. And restorative justice, in my understanding, and I'm not an expert, focuses on the community and sort of the integration of that individual into society at large. It includes, as you were saying, all these different people coming to the table, the victims, if they're still alive, the families, the people who perpetrated the crime, et cetera. And similarly, forgiveness, I actually think, in my conception of forgiveness, and this is my own conception, is a social category. At least when I think about it in terms of death penalty discourse, it's a category of reconciliation between individuals, whereas atonement or salvation is a category that has to do with the individual and their sort of ultimate state, whether you want to have whatever your theological commitments are, if that's something about their state in the afterlife, if that's something about their, how they stand before God, however you want to conceptualize that. And that in many ways, I think it's helpful to sort of separate these two out, how we think about the criminal, the person who has committed a crime, their status as individuals and sort of with themselves before God, however you want to conceptualize that, and also the social status of that individual, how they're integrated into society or separated out from society. And so when you were saying, Jenny, that the sort of human dignity and social status of the individual isn't affected, I actually think those are two different things. And I'm not convinced, I don't know, we've chatted about this a little bit, in my reading of the rabbinic literature, that their social status remains unaffected. I think their social status is highly affected. I think one of the things death penalty discourse does is to really make clear normative boundaries and the severe consequences that can result when normative boundaries are transgressed. And I think it's important just to note, at least in the rabbinic discourse, what we're talking about, the kinds of crimes that people can be executed for, in theory at least, are not just what we may think of as what people are executed for in our society, violent crimes like murder, but also, among others, crimes of adultery, violating the Sabbath, cursing one's parents, worshiping idols, leading others into idolatry, blaspheming God, or bearing false witness against the daughter of a priest. That's a very specific one. But these are a variety of communal norms that are considered, the transgression of which are considered so severe that they place somebody outside sort of the normative boundaries of that community. And that status as outside of the normative boundaries of that community, again, not to be obsessed with this burial thing, is visually represented in their burial outside of the normal communal spaces. They are designated as other, not only in their trial and execution, but also in their burial, at least for a period of time. And again, there's a debate within the sources about whether they can ever be reintegrated. The Tosefta says no, the Talmud says maybe yes, the Mishnah is not clear, but for a period of time, they have crossed, they are beyond the pale in a real sense. And so I think it's quite interesting to reflect on, is there a way to socially place somebody beyond the pale but still affirm their dignity as another human being? Or are those two things at loggerheads with each other, unable, cannot be reconciled? Is there a way to think about punishment that's retributive in the framework of restorative justice, or are those things irreconcilable? Is there a way to think about somebody maybe being able to atone and be saved, but that they don't need to be socially forgiven, or vice versa? I think these are complexly overlapping categories. I don't have great answers to those questions, but they're questions I'm interested in, so I want to at least raise them. I don't know if you guys want to respond to those at this point. I'll leave them dangling, perhaps.
I'm just thinking of, I think the prison system is so flawed that you're getting at some big issues that within the current frame, I don't think can be adequately addressed from the angle of just the prison system. And who I'm thinking about, if any of you guys know who James Gilligan is, he's done a lot of work at Rikers Island, but he's also written a lot on violence within the prison systems themselves and the shaming of prisoners and the fact that that is not useful at all because it just perpetuates violence that the initial shame caused in the first place. Just to give you an example of what that structure looks like, what we were talking about earlier about this idea of the poor staying poor, it's the same kind of concept. So you've got somebody that's in prison that's feeling shame for their inability to pay the fines that prison incurs, for instance. So now they're in prison where their driver's license has been removed. It's the same exact cycle, it's just using different terms than were used earlier. So in order for to mitigate that sense of worthlessness that acts of violence erupt, that's generally the case for people that are imprisoned for gross harms. But the shaming of them through methods of solitary confinement, for instance, perpetuate that shame, and then you get more violence. I mean, so the equation's not working. I already said that, but I'm saying it again in different terms. And so Gilligan's point, and he speaks to a lot of the issues that you just raised, was to just get rid of the whole system and to reconceive it. Now, whether we probably all have opinions on whether that's happening or not, especially within the current administration. But the concept is there has to be a complete reworking where he likes the idea of restorative justice, but he actually doesn't think it can succeed within the current system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, question in the back there, yeah.
Very severe psychological emotional damage. Is there some role for criminal justice to bring them to a greater position of power?
I don't see a role within the current criminal justice system unless we're conceiving that justice system as holding within it restorative justice practices. Although I have to say, this is where, again, I think it's difficult to talk about in brief terms because of what's at stake. And what I think's at stake in those cases are people who have undergone trauma in the framework of restorative justice, who are asked to confront perpetrators who may or may not actually have remorse. And I situate that within a statistic of the sociopath, which is 1 in 4, who does not have the capacity for effective empathy. So the ability to empathize on a cognitive level, they actually can do. So if somebody's crying in front of them, they know that it's right to cry. And there's a neurological mechanism that happens so that they might cry. But the actual ability to feel that emotion is not present. And a lot of people that are enacting these kind of crimes could be diagnosed as such. These are just examples. It's not a full-blown rule. But in any case, asking a person who has undergone that kind of trauma to face a perpetrator at any point, if they don't want to, is a violation of that person's human dignity. So that's where, I mean, and I've seen this enacted in restorative justice. A short anecdote. We took students, mostly women, into a prison in Massachusetts. And I was not forewarned. So I was one of the teachers, but I was not for I what was what I was given press for was that we were going to do restorative justice, and we were going to see how people succeeded, and we were going to talk about liberation, and we were going to talk about forgiveness as a means of liberation, both for the victim and for the perpetrator, and how this, you know, it works. And but what happened was we brought 20, I would say there was about 18 or 19 girls under the age of 20 into a prison where they were talking to prisoners that were in there for murder and sexual violence. So, and it was supposed to be an educational opportunity, and I could not believe what they walked us into without preparation for me as a teacher. So the after effects of this lasted, it lasted a while, because these kids were half law students and half theology students, and they believed in forgiveness. So they went in thinking to be loving, to be kind, to think about theological principles, and we asked them to listen to accounts that I'm sure at least half of those girls were triggered. I'm sure of it, just based on statistics. And so what we ask the survivor to do really has to be weighed in light of every particular situation. And I think forgiveness is part of that. So what do we ask when we ask to forgive? What I would like to see it be envisioned as is a sort of a liberation from the effective results of any particular violation. That's how I would like to envision it. That's different than saying, it's okay that you did that. And or I'm okay that you did that, or however we want to think about forgiveness. So I have a problem with that term. On the other hand, those prisoners were very sorry. I mean, they were reading letters, they were beautiful letters. It's just that there's so much happening in this discourse, and where it's taking place, I think the environment of the prison, it doesn't allow, I think, for real human contact and error and conversation. And so the element that would have to be presented is really a lot of psychological awareness about trauma. And that takes a lot of time. And I think when we're talking about the moral economy, allowing for time and psychological processes are really undermined.
I would just, sorry.
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah. I would just add that as far as I understand, the Talmud separates. The Talmud doesn't really talk about victims when they're talking about criminal punishment. And now I feel like that's a very good idea that they don't. I'm not sure if I have more.
I just wanted to say on this point, and this is well beyond my field of expertise, but my own personal reaction to this question is that, and I guess it's drawing on some of what I see going on in the rabbinic literature about the criminal being what puts somebody beyond the pale. And I think it's an important question for any society to consider. Are there actions that place someone permanently beyond the pale? And an important question for individuals to consider. Are there actions that can place somebody permanently beyond the pale? And, you know, I may know my own answers to that. Everybody in the room may have different answers to that. But if so, I think part of the prison system, in my mind, whether it does this effectively at all in reality, is the idea that is based on the idea that there are things that place somebody beyond where somebody needs to be removed from society for the safety of everybody else, that they cannot be integrated fully into society in some way. And I'm sure this is connected to the history with mental health institutions, which I'm not, again, this is not my expertise. But I think that's one of the core, to me, one of the core issues raised by your question is if we think, and we may not all think, but if we think that there are some things that make somebody too dangerous to be even with some rehabilitative process, a regular participant in society, that it would be too traumatizing for the people that they victimize, for them to be reintegrated, they're a serial killer, we think they're gonna reattack somebody, whatever it is. What do we as a society do with that? And I think we need an answer to that. I don't know that our current prison system is the answer to that, but I think that does. Questions of beyond the pale to me do come out of concern for people who are the victims of crime and their own security and well-being and the sense of the ability that they live in a community that that protects them and considers sort of their safety and upholds the norms that protect them. And those are tensions, I think.
One quick response, which you draw out, was this idea of removal from the community. And a lot of prisoners, where I'm coming in contact with people, are going to be in more liberal locations and places that have restorative justice. But they're very grateful for having been removed. But they're receiving rehabilitation. So I would say the process as a whole is not doing that. Again, it gets back to this idea of addressing the psychological issues and lots of time and really increasing human dignity by, within those particular prisons, they're doing things like growing gardens or doing some kind of work or doing hospice. And so they're being asked to become human beings contributing to a community. And so that's one factor that shifts the balance. But yes, this idea of removal, I think the guys that I've become exposed to would be saying yes, that they support that, that they wouldn't want to eradicate that. It's just then how do you conceptualize what that means? Mm-hmm. Or how do you actually, how does that play out on the ground?
I saw some more questions up front, but I don't remember who.
Well,
yeah.
Dr. Rell, you mentioned Massachusetts. I thought in the New York Review of Books, the Barnes College is teaching literature to prisoners, and the results we're having are astounding, and they're especially the finding they're more motivated than the average college student. They're working harder. They're reading well beyond their assignments. And it just seems like, I don't know the name of the book, but I just happened to think about it.
I've only heard of that tangentially, but I know Bard's doing that, and Boston does that as well. Boston University does that as well, although I think recently something happened with funding.
New Jersey has a statewide program.
They do that too.
Yeah, that actually, my husband is a sociologist. He's a professor in the New Jersey State Prisons, and colleagues of mine from schools in the area who have adjuncted in prisons have said, oh, everyone says the same thing. These are the most motivated students, my husband's comment is always, it's an amazing thing that happens when people who are not treated with dignity throughout their day, so, a few for good reason, most not, what it means to them to interact with a professor, to think on a high level. Most of us who teach in universities are shocked when students do the reading. He has students who come and say, I read the article 3 times. I have a few questions. Right, and this is with very little preparation. Most of them are poor, end up in prison because they're poor. They don't have a lot of opportunities. They don't come from the educational backgrounds that that we all do. And even so, they're it really transforms them to be engaged in higher education.
Yeah, in the back, I can't see your name.
This may be slightly off the subject, but someone used the term beyond the pale. And which reminds me, there were many instances of Jews who cooperated with Nazis during the war. There were capos in the ghettos. There were Israelis who spied on Israel for the Arab countries and such. They were beyond the pale. Some of them were never prosecuted for this. Does rabbinic law recognize a category of people who betray their own people but were not punished? And how does it treat them?
Do you know? I saw some heads nodding for some of the rabbis in the room. This is not something I've studied myself. Do you?
Why don't you take this, Dr. Cooper?
The attention away from the panel. The short answer is yes, there is a rabbinic category called a moser, someone and a very serious relationship with that person and how that person is dealt with. But I refer to the panel to continue their subject.
That pretty much exhausts what I know about that as well.
Noah, yeah.
So I don't know how or if you want to treat this, but one of the things that seems clear from what you're saying, and I agree about rabbinic discourse around capital punishment, which is something redemptive that mm-hmm. happens. So two things about that. One, that's an interesting challenge to the Foucault's model. Once upon a time, we punished. Nowadays, we discipline, and we do it really poorly because that discipline is really about not coming. But Jewish things seem to be a little bit different, right? Because if it's not simply about punishment, but it's been redemptive in there, then maybe there's a challenge to that rubric, which I guess is worth thinking about. But that then leads me to the most famous redemptive execution of all, of course. So within right? Everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? So within the Christian tradition, there is an execution which is in and of itself redemptive of original sin or however you want to work. Think about it. But it also seems to be the execution of Jesus is lying behind so much of what's going on in the Babylonian Talmud's discussion of execution. So how can we in this context, maybe not so much, sum up what at least in that text's musings about it, the Talmud is willing to say, yes, of course we executed Jesus. We executed Jesus and it was one of the best things we ever did, which is a different response than most people, I think, are taught. So what about that? And what about that paradigmatic execution? Can we talk about the moral economy in Judaism and Christian sources without thinking about the execution of Jesus of Nazareth in some sort of serious way?
I don't know how it foregrounds. I don't know how it foregrounds in Babylonian times. I can only think about how it justifies suffering right now.
So maybe
how that image, it's not the okay. I was not preparing to answer you. when I think of that image, and it's a very used one within the Catholic Church, because that is, I mean, the Jesus on the cross, nailed on the cross, is a very particular and important image. And I think it's one of the core symbols that distance Catholics from Christians, because the Christians will remove that image. And so therefore, our focus is on the suffering. And it's a joke that Catholics have, right? Because we're all suffering together. And their focus is on salvation. So that this other world, and I'm saved from my sins, and Jesus Christ is my Savior. And that's not really where we go as we talk. But the problem with that is just that it justifies, in many systems, it justifies the concept of suffering, because Jesus suffered and we suffer with him. The term is, you're carrying your cross. That's your cross to bear. It gets back to the idea of forgiveness and this thought that if somebody's done something wrong to you, well, that's your cross to bear. And so you bear it and move on and you forgive. And then right behind forgiveness is forgetting, which we all know how problematic that is in this room. So that's where I would go with that discourse.
I'm thinking of co-opting your question for other purposes. It's very hard to know what is in the background of rabbinic texts. To me, that's why they're so useful in a context like this, and when we're thinking about how or if, to what extent, and in what context we can look to religion and religious texts to inform or shape or just push us when we think about the actual legal and political and social world that we live in today on a broader level beyond our individual religious communities. Probably not just rabbinic texts, but many ancient texts and religious texts that are designed and used for inspirational purposes, sort of point us in directions and don't tell us why they've said certain things. And so it gets our wheels turning in really useful ways. I've said before that I'm never looking to, in terms of criminal justice, in many ways, I'm not at all looking to the Talmud for the conclusions that they come to. There are some cases where they come to, I think, really wonderful conclusions. But the very starting point that, you know, I'm against the death penalty, and so you could say, well, this should all be a non-starter. Why would I read that tractate of Talmud at all? But the point is that it points us in good directions. I don't think from a historical and literary perspective that early Christianity is what's, or the crucifixion of Jesus or Christian texts is what's in the background here, but we can't know for certain. So I don't want to sort of say that too definitively. I think we can use the Christian traditions about all these things to be in conversation today, even if they weren't in conversation 2,000 years ago.
So So we didn't give you all the definitive answer on the afterlife, which was promised earlier on today. Unfortunately, we'll have to save that for another time. All I will say, it's there somewhere, but I don't know if we have it. All I will say is that one thing that's clearly emerged is that conceptions, theological conceptions, and sort of the horizon in which you think about an individual human life, and whether that's just one step in your overall life and status in the universe, however that's conceptualized in different traditions, really can reframe what we think is going on in death penalty discourse. So if you think that ultimately you have an eternal life somewhere beyond this one, and that's what's the most important, execution can be framed in a very different way than if you think we die and that's the end of it. So on that, one last comment, very, very quick.
I'm not good at that.
Actually. Okay. I just want to keep us, I don't know who has trains, et cetera, so I'm going to keep us on time. So I will just say, with that note of shifting horizons, I want to add my gratitude towards everybody else, refocus on our horizons of this conference, to what everybody said before. Thank you so much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.